I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 31st, 2024, and the time is 3:30 p.m. A reminder to silence your cell phones. Members present today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Co-Chair Giesel. Excused today from committee is Senators Bishop and Klayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And thank you to Sav Danbert, who is recording the minutes, and Dylan Williams, who's doing the audio today. So today we have three items on the agenda. First of all, we'll have public testimony on House Bill 125, that's trapping cabins on state land. And that will be followed by the first hearing of Senate Bill 198, state land for remote recreation cabin sites, by the governor. And the first hearing with public testimony on the Executive Order 128, separating the Board of Directors of the Alaska Energy Authority from the Board of Directors of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. So, first of all, we will do House Bill 125. So, House Bill 125 is trapping cabins on state land. It comes from the House Resources Committee. I don't think we have any members of that Resources Committee present to refresh us on the bill. Am I correct? Okay. So we'll go right to public testimony. And I see two people have signed up to speak. We'll start with Peter, I bet it's Peter Buist, perhaps, in Fairbanks, and he'll be followed by Al Barrett, also in Fairbanks. Mr. Buist, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself, tell us any affiliations you might have, and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. My name's Pete Buist. I'm from Fairbanks. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska Trappers Association in support of HB 125. We are a statewide group with about 1,200 dues-paying members. And we appreciate the opportunity to testify. I have a somewhat unique perspective on the original legislation and trapper cabin statute as a founding member and past president of the Alaska Trappers Association. I worked closely with Representative Red Swanson of Nenana more than 40 years ago to draft the original legislation that addressed the critical need for trappers to be able to construct essential winter shelter on trap lines on state lands. Later, as a DNR employee, now long retired, I also helped to administer it. I issued the very first trapper cabin construction permit to Larry Hensley of McGrath many, many moons ago. It's been a popular permit, and there have been few abuses. It helps to prevent trespass cabin issues. Another point that I would stress is that this is an issue that is supported by both urban and rural trappers in our membership. The critical need for effective winter shelter is common to all long trapline trappers. It's not a luxury item or a recreational commodity. It's for survival. So over the years, it has become obvious to both the trapping community and to DNR that a few changes were necessary. HB 125 addresses most of these, and I urge you to pass the bill out. We've worked in concert with DNR to craft legislation which cures most of the current administrative problems that have caused this once worthwhile and smoothly run program to flounder in recent years. Almost 10 years ago, DNR decided for some reason that the statute would not allow them to renew trapper cabin permits. And that caused a lot of problems. We worked with the agency to come up with this new legislation, which allows renewal, increases the yearly permit fee, as well as brings much needed security back to the permitting system. During the discussions on this bill, we've heard the idea advanced that during the off season, trapper cabins could be used by other recreational users. We don't think this is practical or fair. Trappers who hold the permits are responsible for the cabins in the immediate area. They also need the contents, firewood, food, gear, and so forth, in their shelter during the winter trapping season. Trapping cabins and their contents can be the difference between life and death for a trapper. Allowing others to use the cabins could put the permitted trapper in a bad situation and, for that matter, cause some liability. The use of these cabins for just trapping is already cast in statute. Allowing other uses would completely change the demand for cabins and cause a plethora of side problems. They're for trapping. They are specifically not multiple-use cabins. We'd appreciate your support, and I thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Buist. Any questions for him? Seeing none, thank you very much for taking the time to speak today. Next up is Al Barrett, also in Fairbanks. Mr. Barrett, you've testified before, I know, but just remember, identify yourself and your affiliations. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Giesel and Vice Chair Wielichowski. For the record, my name is Al Barrett. I reside in Fairbanks. And for disclosure, I am a Board of Game member, but I'm not representing the Board of Game in this hearing. I support this bill and encourage the committee members to pass it out of the Senate resources. It's days and weeks like we are going through right now. Yards of snow falling in southeast Alaska, 20 and 30 below temperatures in south central Alaska, and 40 and 50 or below even more in the interior. This is one of the reasons we need trap line cabins. There are a lot of trappers right now in their families that are thankful they have a warm place and a dry place to stay at and weather out this harsh weather conditions. As urban populations expand, trappers are having to go further out. They need to know they could apply for a trap line permit that is somewhat simple to apply for and affordable so they can continue their traditional lifestyle. I think in 1992 was the last time that I could leave Fairbanks and travel to Anchorage and only have one stoplight in between, and that was in Wasilla. And that's the end of my testimony, Senator Giesel and members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barrett. Any questions for Mr. Barrett? Seeing none, thank you very much for taking the time today. And that is the end of the folks that are online for public testimony. So at this point, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 125, and we're going to set the bill aside for today. So next item up is Senate Bill 198. This will be the first hearing of the bill today, which is state land for remote recreational cabin sites. And so I will invite Commissioner John Boyle to the table, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, to make comments. Also online, we have Christopher Orman. He's an Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law, Natural Resources Section. And also in the room is Christy Coles, Director, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. So welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Giesel and honorable members of the committee. This is John Boyle, Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources for the record, and I'm pleased to be joined here by Christy Collis, who's my Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And I just thought I'd start with a few kind of opening comments on SB 198, just to give the committee a landscape-level view of what this bill aims to do. And its real intent is really to give DNR a new suite of options and a toolkit in which we can offer more land to Alaskans that are interested in achieving that Alaska dream. I think, as we all know, land prices in our state have been steadily increasing. And if you're one of the next generation of Alaskans like myself, it's not necessarily as easy or affordable to find yourself with the ideal recreational property that you might want to have for your family. And so recognizing just the expense and the challenge of providing lands to Alaskans, the governor put forward this legislation, I think, to enable us to look at different options of how we can make acquiring land more affordable and more accessible to a broader swath of the public. So SB 198 would, in essence, repeal and reenact the existing recreational remote cabin site staking program statute, which we currently have in AS 3805-600. Again, to increase those opportunities for Alaskan residents to either permit, lease, and or purchase state land for a remote recreational cabin site. This bill outlines a procedure and a process to be followed when the commissioner offers available land, and it also gives the public the ability to nominate land to be permitted, leased, and or purchased, and then, of course, directs the commissioner to establish regulations to implement said program. SB 198 also allows the commissioner annually to identify areas where land is properly classified and to publish and provide public notice for an annual schedule of land offerings suitable for remote recreational sites and to offer those lands for staking. It also allows Alaskans to nominate up to 10 acres of unencumbered land for remote recreational sites that can be staked by an eligible participant. The commissioner could then approve the nomination without a written best interest finding. If the nominated land is not properly classified, the commissioner may classify or reclassify that land per existing statutes. Of course, the applicant will still be responsible for the administrative costs associated with the classification process. And after approval, the applicant who nominated the land would then have 90 days to basically stake the parcel, or the land could be included in our annual land offering. SB 98 also establishes a process for Alaskans to stake and purchase a piece of state land for a remote recreational site. That process would require the applicant to pay the costs for the appraisal, to survey, and then plat the site, and then the commissioner would then set the price, sale price of that land at fair market value at the time that staking process took place. The bill also establishes a process for leasing a remote recreational site with an initial 10-year term and two additional 10-year term lease renewal periods. Again, I think the concept here is that it would give folks the opportunity that might not have the financial means to go out and purchase lands or to pay for expensive things like surveying, the opportunity to get out and more or less make a test run at whether the cabin life is for them, and if it would work, and gives them an opportunity to then extend that for a couple of two additional 10-year lease renewal periods. Of course, these leases may not be assigned, and has a provision to allow for the termination of these leases for non-compliance. At the end of that, the lessee may purchase that cabin site at any time during the lease as well. And lastly, the bill would provide for a permit to be issued for a remote recreational site for a 5-year term with four additional 5-year renewal periods. And these permits may not be assigned. It would be revocable at the direction of the commissioner and may be terminated for any reason, including failure to use the permitted land as required by the terms of the permit. The permittee, like the lessee, would be eligible to lease or purchase the site, and if the land subject to the permit is offered for sale or lease, the commissioner shall first offer that site to the permittee. And of course, the bill would provide that if a permit or lease is terminated, improvements or personal property remaining on the land would be handled as provided in AS 3805090. So fundamentally, again, this bill is designed to increase the availability of recreational land for Alaskans, and Christy can now walk us through the technical aspects of the bill, if that suits the committee's purpose.
Sure. If we could just pause for a moment. Any questions for the commissioner? Senator Kawasaki?
I guess I'll wait until we go.
Okay. All right. Great. Director Coles.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Christy Collis. I'm the director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Thank you for having me here today to go through the SB 198. Settling and developing our lands is inherent in our Constitution, and this legislation provides a variety of opportunities to meet both constitutional mandate as well as the governor's agenda for getting more lands into Alaskans' hands. SB 198 would repeal and reenact the existing remote recreational cabin site staking program statute to increase opportunities for Alaska residents to permit, lease, and purchase state land for a remote recreational cabin site. The bill outlines a process to be followed when the commissioner offers available land and the ability for the public to nominate land to be permitted, leased, or purchased and directs the commissioner to establish regulations to implement the program. The bill provides for the commissioner to annually identify areas where land is properly classified, publish and provide public notice for an annual schedule of land offerings, and offer those lands for staking. It also allows Alaskans to nominate 10 acres, up to 10 acres, of unencumbered land for remote recreational sites to be staked by an eligible applicant. The commissioner could then approve the nomination without a written best interest finding. If the nominated land is not properly classified, the commissioner may classify or reclassify it per existing statutes. The applicant would be responsible for administrative costs associated with the reclassification process, and after approval, the applicant who nominated the land would have 90 days to stake the parcel, or the land may be included in the annual land offering. All right, so we can go through more of specifics on the different authorization types. The bill would provide for a permit to be issued for a remote recreational site for a 5-year term with 4 additional 5-year renewal periods. The permits may not be assigned and would be revocable at the discretion of the commissioner and may be terminated for any reason, including failure to use the permitted land as required by the terms of the permit. The permittee would be eligible to lease or purchase a site, and if the land subject to the permit is offered for sale or lease, the commissioner shall first offer the site to the permittee. So our leasing option. The bill would establish a process for leasing a remote recreational site with an initial 10-year term and 2 additional 10-year lease renewal periods. Leases may not be assigned, and the lease can be terminated for non-compliance. The lessee may purchase the site at any time during the lease term.
Pause 1 second. Sure. Senator Wilikowski, question.
Thank you. Can you explain the current process and how this changes it?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. So right now we have the ability to, we put out an offering every other year of land that you could stake. So if we have an area that we've identified, let's say 300 acres, and we could say 20 people can go in and stake between 5 to 20 acres of land in this area. We select, if we have more than 20 people that apply, then we do have to do a drawing of those 20 people. So maybe 10 people wouldn't be able to actually go out and stake. They go out to the area, they stake their land, and then they would enter into a lease. It's a short-term lease, and it's really just an interim authorization to get them into contract as they get a survey and appraisal of the land. Because land could be, the price per acre could differ if it's maybe water, if they're on the lake. Maybe they're not on the lake, then it might be less. And so then they enter into that lease. Once they get the survey and the appraisal done, they enter into a contract, or maybe they can outright purchase it because they have cash. If they enter into a contract, they can have 20 years to pay off the price of the parcel. And then once they pay it off, then they would go to patent.
Just follow up, Senator.
Just trying to understand the basic process and what we're changing here. Is there a maximum number of acres that are available for lease during when these sales come up? That's number one. And number two is just how does this bill fundamentally change this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. We set the acreage based off of the area. So usually it's between 5 to 20 acres for any of our current sales. So if somebody wants maybe 10 acres, they can stake 10 acres, but they can go anywhere from 5 to 20. And then what fundamentally changes in this bill is that we don't currently have a permit program or a leasing program for people to utilize. So there is not this ability to just continue under a lease under the current program. We want to get them into a sale and a contract under the current program. So those are the main fundamental differences. Also, we do have to do a best interest finding under the current program. This legislation would exempt us from that process. We would still do a decision just because it is an appealable process. Any decision we make as a department is appealable. So we would have something for the record. We'd still do a decision. Public notice would still be required per the Constitution. So we would do a public notice, but it just wouldn't be per the statute. We would just do that based off of kind of the constitutional mandate.
I have a lot more questions, but I see others answering. So.
All right. Senator Dunbar was next, and then we'll be Senator Kelsop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To sort of follow up on that, and then I have a separate question. I guess I'd like to hear more. Why get rid of the written best interest finding? Sort of why you're doing that, why you want to do that. And second, you know, there are a number of us, and I think actually the department too, who'd like to see a lot more public use cabins and, you know, a lot more folks who maybe can't afford to purchase but want to bring their family out into, you know, into recreational sites. And Alaska is really underdeveloped when it comes to public use cabins versus a lot of other parts of the world and parts of the country. There are relatively few of them. And so I guess my question is, you know, if one of these sites is identified we want to put a public use cabin in there in the future, you know, and how does that interact with us basically privatizing certain state-held lands now? Can we at a later date sort of recover that land under this program for a public use cabin? Or are the types of land for public use versus these kind of remote cabins, you know, fundamentally different?
Right. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. First question on the best interest finding. So we do have other authorizations that are exempted under a best interest finding under that statute 3805035E. And it's just very prescriptive of how we must write that decision. The department still would write a decision. It just wouldn't have to follow that specific process. So it helps streamline our ability to get more lands out to Alaskans. So we would, like I said, still have a public notice. There would still be a process. It just wouldn't be as prescriptive as what's in the current statute. And as I said, there are other programs that we have that are exempted. And then when it comes to the public use cabins, so Parks is the one that usually has those public use cabins because they have park rangers and they have staff and to be able to manage those cabins. The Division of Mine Land and Water, we manage all the other general state land, but we don't have staff or rangers to go out and kind of monitor and make sure these cabins would be safe. So typically, if we have any kind of cabin systems that people could use, it's from a nonprofit coming to us and saying, I would like to, you know, use this cabin that maybe is a trespass cabin that's not being utilized, or maybe we're going to build a cabin and we want to be able to make it safe and have some sort of reservation system for the public to use. And I think we could look at some of these cabins if in the future, let's say this legislation goes through, people have had permits and they've resurrected some sort of a structure, then we could decide if in the future that was appropriate for us to maybe use those for some sort of a public purpose. Because under the statute that the commissioner referenced, 3805090, if somebody leaves a structure on state land and they don't remove it, then it becomes property of the state. We always give them a chance to remove it. And if it's over a certain dollar amount and we go and we sell it, then we would have to refund them for whatever money that we made off of that additional infrastructure.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just add on to that for Senator Dunbar's edification through the chair. John Boyle, Commissioner, for the record. The department is very supportive of the concept of expanding our network of public use cabins, and we are having our Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation take a look at which of our park units in particular would benefit from having broader access. I think as we look at areas to expand access to public use cabins, we are generally looking at those areas near or adjacent to urban centers, roads, infrastructure that allows relative easy access to those areas. And generally, those are areas that are legislatively designated areas as parks or other units that have exceptional values, whether scenic or otherwise. So we're definitely focused on that element as well. And I think the lands for settlement tend to be a little different category as we compare apples to oranges in that case.
Castle Brief follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
I hear you, Commissioner, although I will say, looking at the lands that are available here, you provide us a map. Some of them are actually pretty close to Fairbanks, to the Mat-Su, along the highway. I mean, some of them do look fairly desirable, especially as, I mean, I think the public desire for public use cabins is also pretty dramatically increased. And there's the Long Trail Project, right, which would run through some of these lands. So I guess my question is there a a mechanism now to allow the Parks Department, you know, to look at some of these lands. You know, I mean, currently they're looking at their own lands, but, you know, what if Parks does identify some of these lands as highly desirable for that public use cabin network? I mean, is there a mechanism now where they could take advantage of this and also have access to some of these cabin sites?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, and for the record, this is Christy Collis. So the map that you're referring to is our classified settlement lands. So those are lands that, and you're correct, some of those are on the road system, because we use that classification for not only this remote recreational program, but also for our subdivision program that we have. So that's a different program where we actually develop subdivisions, they're platted. You don't get to pick kind of your corners and your location. So we do use those lands more for settlement, for our auction subdivision sales. And so that's why you're seeing some of those closer to roads. But, you know, when it comes to whether or not Parks could utilize those lands, I mean, we would always be willing to partner with Parks if they identified an area. We already work with them closely on areas that are not an LDA that they manage for public use. And so we have instruments that we use to give them that management authority. So if they desired that, that's something we could definitely do.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the worksheets that are here that kind of talk about what it is currently. And so my question is sort of similar because it looks like the two or three first set of flags are being compressed into one. And also, I think a major part is that the best interest finding is not necessary under 3805.035E. Can you tell me what typically that takes as far as how much time that takes? I mean, that seems to be the part that takes a long time.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. So, Kawasaki, sorry. It's basically before we can go out to the public, we have to draft a decision that lays out all of the information that we might need to have in a final decision. So we need to look at title, and we need to look at classification. We need to look at traditional uses. And so we need to put that all in a decision for the public in called a two-step. So that's the first step that we take. And it takes us a while to get that out just because there's a lot of research. As you guys all know, too, we are constantly hiring and training. And so, you know, it's not a simple process. So bringing somebody brand new on, they can't just pick these up and usually write a decision very quickly. So that takes time as well. And so then we go out with it. We take in comments. We have to address those comments. And then we go out with a final finding and decision. The difference with a one-step decision is we would go out to the public and we would tell them, we've got either an application, we are considering doing this action, and then we would get comments from the public. And then after we get those comments, then we would write a decision that would then go out. The public would still have the right to appeal that decision, just as they would with a decision that was drafted under 035E. But it helps us in streamlining and kind of finding out the problems before we draft a decision. We can actually go to the public, hear the concerns, and that helps us with addressing those issues before going through the whole decision process beforehand.
Follow up, just that under 035E, if this were to be removed and replaced essentially with just the record of decision, is that enough for the Department of Natural Resources to feel like they've gotten enough information about the area, whether it has a clear and appropriate title, whether there are other mitigating circumstances or minerals, those types of things, and then whether the public would have enough opportunity. I think it's a multi-step process when it's a best interest finding that folks will have two different times in which they're able to sort of make public comment. Do you feel comfortable that you would give the public enough time to sort of respond to that?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. You know, the public actually only gets one bite of the apple, even in a two-step, because they're seeing it as it's drafted in a decision document when they're seeing it in public notice. So easements, for example, we don't go out with a full-blown decision for an easement because it's not required per the statute. But we do tell the public where that's going to be located. We try to provide maps. We try to provide enough information that they can make an informed, you know, comment to us if they're concerned. And so then we do draft, and we still do have to look at title. We still, but in the background, as the public is maybe chewing on this, we're still looking at title. We're still looking at classification. We're still making sure that this is an appropriate, because we're saying we're considering this. We're not saying it is for sure happening. We're saying this is something the department is considering. Give us your comments. And then once we get the comments and we get all this other information, we can draft that decision, send it out to the public, send it to whoever might have been the applicant, and then the appeal process could occur.
Thank you, Director. Thanks.
All right. I see no further questions. I'll let you continue.
All right. All right. So then that leads us to the process of purchase. The bill would establish a process for Alaskans to stake and purchase a piece of state land for remote recreational sites. The process requires the applicant to pay the cost for appraisal, survey, and platting the site, and for the commissioner to set the sale price at fair market value. Okay, so here's the question of what lands are available. I think everyone recognizes this map. All the blue represents the state ownership. State land is classified through our planning process that undergoes agency and public engagement. Classification of state land assists the department in making decisions on development and disposals. The department must also classify lands prior to disposal. Types of classifications are agricultural, coal, forestry, geothermal, grazing, material, mineral, oil and gas, heritage resources, public recreation, reserve use, resource management, transportation corridor, waterfront development, water resources, wildlife habitat, and settlement. The settlement classification are the lands identified for disposal into private ownership. The land, if land is not designated a settlement, then a reclassification can be considered and would follow the existing process set out in law. And we do this often already because the fact is we do our best to classify lands appropriately when we're going through the planning process, but of course things change. Alaska's quite large, and so we don't always have all the information. So if new information comes to us, if an applicant comes to us, or if we find out that this should be classified differently, then we do go through this process for other authorizations as well. So this is the statewide settlement lands. We have approximately 3,544,344 acres across the state that's already classified as settlement lands. And like I said, this would be for both programs, and it currently is used for both programs.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, question?
Thanks. Thank you, Director. Can you just tell me, like, why is there like a random dot in the middle of the state and why that was settled and like other land hasn't been settled? Is there like a particular reason, or is it maybe there was a settlement there at some point? Just kind of curious.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, random dot?
I meant like, yeah. Yeah, just like an isolated blue settlement.
So when we go through these planning processes, we work through the local communities. We work with the public. There could be reasons why it was identified. Maybe there was ideas of future settlement or development in that area. Some of these planning plans are over 20 years old. We do our best to try to update them more often, but just with resources, it's such a large effort. It takes usually 2 to 5 years to do because there is so much engagement that changing an entire area plan does take a lot of time. So that's why we do this reclassification process when we don't have the ability to go up and update these. So that's probably why you're seeing those, is just at some point someone thought it was a great idea.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there is a distinction between area to be settled and this recreational cabin program in the sense that I'm curious how you define recreational in this case then. So is there a limit on the number of days in a year someone can be at a recreational cabin before it becomes a permanent residence? Mm-hmm. And, if you, we just heard a trapping cabin, you know, I think, for example, is trapping considered recreation? Is mining considered recreation? So how do you define what they can and can't do at these recreational sites?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, we don't have it defined in statute on what recreational is versus what having a domicile would be. So we don't, if somebody gets one of these cabins and decides they want to live out there, we wouldn't stop them from living out in their cabin if they want to be remote. But one thing that we look at when we're trying to decide between a remote recreational area and a subdivision sale is usually, typically, you're going to have it be where the access is limited by plane or boat or snow machine, where some of our subdivision sales are right off the road. Thousand Skies is a good one. It's right before Glen Allen. We have phase one already in. It's a popular area just because of all the different recreational opportunities. We've sold a lot of parcels subdivision. We're going to have a phase two, but we're also going to, we're thinking about doing a recreational opportunity further out. So it would not be connected by road. And so that's kind of how we look at it is those more far out, you're not going to probably be able to live out there as much just because of the fact it's going to be accessed by plane or boat. And then typically they're cheaper as well because the fair market value for limited access is going to cause that to be a lower value.
Brief follow-up. Yes. I mean, what it sounds like to me is whether it was intentional or not, recreational is kind of a vestigial tale then. I mean, the word recreational is not necessary. This is just, these are remote cabins. You can use them for any purpose. We call them recreational, but they're just effectively, they're just remote cabins. We're selling remote cabins. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, that is fair to say, but one caveat with the remote recreational sites right now, if you're in a lease, we do have it limited that you cannot use it for commercial purposes because we are trying, we'd rather have commercial entities come to us and, you know, get different authorizations for those types of activities. But we do have that limitation. But once we sell it, there's no covenant on it. So you could use it then for commercial purposes. And the ability for us to monitor that and manage that would be impossible. So once you sell it, once you get the deed, we're not going to manage that after it.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. In the statute, page 8, lines 8 and 9, it says an eligible applicant may nominate and apply for a permit lease or sale of up to 10 acres of available state land. And just the definition of available state land, is, are you referring to the dots that we're seeing on slide 8, those blue dots? Is that available state land for purposes of this statute?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, but it also has to not be encumbered. I mean, this information is just very high level what we have in our system right now. Of course, if somebody is going to really want to hone in on an area, we're going to need to make sure there's not some other authorization. There's not some reason why we cannot convey that land to somebody in the future. Maybe there's already an authorization there. Maybe it's already slated for another sale. So it can't have any kind of encumbrances on it.
Just for the record, can you give me a definition of available state land for page 8, section C?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I would say that that's does not have any existing valid rights already on it. No one has a right to that land already.
Okay, and follow-up.
Follow-up.
So... How many acres are there of available state land? Did you say about 3 million?
Yes, correct.
And that those are the areas that are listed on this slide 8 in the blue dots.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, correct.
Thank you.
All right, no other questions? I'll let you go on.
All right, so this is just more zoomed in maps, just trying to show you the different regions we have. I have questions on this. And this is in the northern area. We have over 1,309,586 acres classified. And these are areas that are already classified, but like I said, this is a small portion of what we have for state lands, but they have other classifications that we'd have to consider on a case-by-case basis. The South Central region has over 2,167,824 acres classified. And then in our southeast, you know, we're a little bit smaller. As you guys all know, we have a lot of federal lands in the southeast, 66,932 acres that are classified as settlement. So if that, if it pleases the committee, I could go through the sectional.
Yes, please.
Okay, great. Section 1 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to add a statement of purpose. Section 2 amends AS 3805035E, outlining the powers and duties of the director of the Division of Lands, to add a new E6I, stating that the director is not required to issue a written finding before approval of a remote recreational cabin site permit, lease, or sale under AS 3805600. Section 3 amends AS 3805045, the statute stating that in general, but with some exceptions, all land owned in fee by the state may be sold as provided in AS 3805045 through 0.069 and in AS 38.08. To add that this statute does not prevent the disposition of land as provided in AS 3805600. Section 4 amends 3805065B, the statute providing terms of contract for sale, to state that a contract for land sold under AS 3805600, the remote recreational cabin site statute, to add a requirement for installment payments of no more than 20 years on a level payment basis at interest rates set by AS 3805.065I. Section 5 amends AS 3805.125A, the statute listing reservations for contracts for sale, lease, or grant of state land, and each deed to state land properties or interest in state land, to add AS 3805600 to the list of statutes subject to the reservations laid out in 0.125A. Section 6 amends AS 3805600 by repealing the existing remote recreational site statute and reenacting it as follows. A states that the commissioner shall provide for the permitting, lease, and sale of state land for remote recreational sites to eligible applicants as described in B and C. B states the commissioner shall publish an annual schedule of land offerings that lists areas available for staking of remote recreational cabin sites. The department will provide public notice of the annual schedule and applicants may apply for sites. C states that eligible applicants may nominate unencumbered land and apply for a permit, lease, or sale of up to 10 acres of state land that is not included in the commissioner's schedule of land offerings. D states the commissioner may classify or reclassify nominated land if nominated land is not classified to allow for remote recreational cabin sites. The applicant would be responsible for all administrative costs associated with reclassification. The department shall provide public notice of the nomination, and if the applicant fails to stake the land within 90 days of approval, the commissioner may include the land in the annual schedule of offerings.
Question? Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, the nomination, this is a new, we don't have nominations right now. This is new, correct?
Through the chair, correct, Senator Wilkowski. We do not currently have, we have, people could tell us that they would like us to consider an area, but there is not a nomination for, you know, them to specifically call out an area and then be able to go and actually stake.
I have some questions on this section, Madam Chair, if I could. So the first question is, it says an eligible applicant may nominate and apply for a permit, lease, or sale of up to 10 acres of available state lands. Does this limit an applicant to nominating one parcel, or could they nominate a parcel in South Central, a parcel in Southeast, a parcel in the northern region, or could they nominate multiple parcels? How does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So eligible applicant, I believe in the definition, defines it that they must have not participated. They can only do it once, and they can only participate once every 10 years. So it they couldn't just nominate all over the state. They would only get that one opportunity.
Okay, great. And then if I can, Madam Chair,
yes,
classifying and why would the commission need to classify or reclassify nominated lands?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, because if the land is not already classified settlement, then we would need to consider whether or not reclassifying, let's say it's wildlife habitat land, we would need to consider whether or not it would be appropriate for us to reclassify it to settlement to allow for the disposal.
So follow up.
Yes.
I thought you said the slide that we saw before, I thought was settlement lands that were eligible. Is it broader? On slide 8, it was statewide settlement lands. And I asked you if those blue dots, next slide, were the slide 8, the dots that were available. But now you're saying lands might be able to, can be reclassified?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, correct. So these are lands that we currently could say are available for people to go out and stake without going through the reclassification process. This map showing all of state land is land that someone could come to us and say, I'd like to nominate up to 10 acres in a different area that's not already classified, and then we would have to go through a reclassification process. And that's not a guarantee based off the fact that it might not be in our best interest to reclassify it if it has mineral interest, if it has a reason that maybe fish and game doesn't support it, maybe it's got timber. It just really depends on how it's classified.
Okay. So I appreciate the show map. I can't read, I can't understand the map at all. It's too small, but maybe it's just me because I'm getting older. But so this would appear, go to the next slide. It would appear that it's not just the blue dots that are, somebody could come in and say, hey, I want to nominate a 10-acre parcel along the Kenai River, for example. It's not on this list, but I'd like you to reclassify it, and I'd like to get a 10-acre parcel on Kenai River. Is that possible?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is possible.
And then through that, if I could?
Please.
Through that nomination process, then, as I read the statute, they pretty much just get it. Right, you got to put out a public notice, but then I guess you do some kind of appraisal, and then they just get it. Is that how it works?
Through the chair.
If you decide to reclassify it.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, correct. If we decide, but we do need to go through a decision process, public notice to decide whether or not reclassifying is appropriate or not.
And there's no best interest finding, right?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, for the reclassification process. We do go through a decision process, and there is public notice that is required per statute 3805945 that has very strict requirements for any classifications that we are going to do, reclassifications included. So we would be following that process if we're considering lands that are not already settlement lands.
Is there a best interest finding for that process?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, can't quite remember if it's a full-blown best interest finding. I apologize. I can get that information to the committee.
Okay. And so if I could, Madam Chair. So then piece of land, it's wildlife habitat on the Kenai River. It's probably extremely valuable. I come in. People will flock to those lands. You know this. There will be now this unbelievable amount of lands that are available, which I'm not opposed to opening up remote lands. I am concerned about opening up lands like next to the Kenai River, for example, that would then block potential fishermen access or hunting access. And so now that process occurs, and then you put out public notice. And then if correct me if I'm wrong, but if the commissioner approves that, then does it then go out for public sale, or does that person just get it at fair market value?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, if they nominated the land and we approve the reclassification, then they would get the land. If they stake within 90 days. If they do not stake within 90 days, then it would go out in the commissioner's regularly scheduled offering.
Just a comment. Yes. That seems extreme. Yeah, that concerns me greatly, that process.
Any other questions? All right, I'll let you proceed.
Okay. I believe this is where we left off. C states that eligible applicants may nominate unencumbered land and apply for permit lease or sale of up to 10 acres of state land that is not included in the commissioner's schedule of land offerings. D states the commissioner may classify or reclassify nominated land if nominated land is not classified to allow for remote recreational cabin sites. The applicant would be responsible for all administrative costs associated with reclassification. The department shall provide public notice of the nomination, and if the applicant fails to stake the land within 90 days of approval, the commissioner may include the land in the annual schedule of offerings. E states the commissioner may issue a permit to an eligible applicant for a term of not more than 5 years. The permit could be renewed up to 4 times for 5 years per renewal. Permits are revocable at will and may be terminated by the commissioner for any reason. The permittee is eligible to lease or purchase a site, and if the land subject to the permit is offered for sale or lease, the commissioner shall first offer the site to the permittee. F states that the commissioner may issue a lease for a term not more than 10 years with 2 10-year renewals. A lease may be terminated by the commissioner if a lessee fails to use the land according to the terms of the lease. The lessee may purchase the site at any time during the lease. G states the annual fees for permits and leases shall be set by the commissioner in accordance with AS 3805073M to ensure the state receives a fair market return. After the termination of a permit or lease, improvements or personal property remaining on the land shall be handled as provided in AS 3805090. A lease or permit may not be assigned. H states that sales must be at fair market value at the time of entry, and the purchaser must pay the cost of appraisal, survey, and platting. I states the commissioner may adopt regulations to implement this section. J provides definitions for eligible applicant and resident. Section 7 amends the uncodified law by adding a new section relating to transition, stating that a lease executed under AS 3805600 before the effective date of this act and in effect on the effective date of this act is eligible for renewal under AS 3805600 as repealed and reenacted in Section 6 of this bill. Section 8 provides for an immediate effective date under AS 0110.070C.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
I have a couple, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Yes.
First of all, are there any restrictions on what you can build on these sites? So, you know, it's cabins, but what is a cabin? And does it have to be within the trapper cabins, for example, had a restriction on the number of square feet. Is there any kind of restriction in that way on these cabins?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunbar, no, we don't have anything in statute at this time. And when we, our current program, we do not have restrictions on those.
So, I mean, it's interesting. This bill is for remote recreational cabins. But as we've sort of defined, as Senator Wilkowski got to, because of the nomination process and because some of the settlement lands are close to the road, they don't have to be remote. And we don't define recreation, so they don't have to be recreational. And we don't define cabins, so they don't have to be a cabin. So we're just selling land, which is fine. I mean, it's fine. But these aren't remote. They're not recreational. They're not a cabin, right? And so I guess my question is, how many acres per year does the department anticipate will be sold under this statute versus our current statute?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunbar, you know, I don't have those types of numbers. I can tell you what we sell now. And so I could tell you that, you know, if, for example, in 2023, 1,920 acres were offered. Let's see if I can find one that what actually gets sold and patented. In 2007, we had a total of 4,100 acres offered, and we ended up contracting or patenting 1,159 acres under this particular program. That's one example that I think shows some good numbers. 2009, similar, 5,600 acres offered, 1,085 actually patented. And, you know, we have different amount of authorizations that we also issue. And the numbers have gone down over the years. You know, back in 2001, we had 295 authorizations offered. But then only nine areas. And then we actually had 1,118 acres actually sold. So it just, it varies on the area, you know, how interested people are, what kind of access it has. You know, if it's got lakes, then floatplane pilots could maybe be a little more interested. If it's got a river, then you can use your snow machine to go up and down in the winter and a boat in the summer.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up, Denver.
So the request here is for 5 positions. How many positions currently does the department have for this program?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, Dunbar.
We're all becoming Bill.
Because you asked me so many questions. sorry about that. So we have currently 1 specialist 3 and then 1 other that assist. And you know, not too many people just wear 1 hat in our division. So we have a manager that oversees the entire program. So, you know, she sees many programs. So 1 really dedicated staff, I would say, and then another person that assists when the time is needed. Because we offer our current program biannually.
So may I ask a quick follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So it sounds like you have about 2 full-time folks working on this now. You're asking for 5 more. So if I'm reading this right. So does that sort of indicate that you expect to sell about 2.5 times more land? But it's also going to be more efficient. So maybe it'll be even more than 2.5 times. I mean, are we thinking like 3, 4, 5 times as much land that we expect to sell per year once this revision goes through?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. And 1 correction, too, that I want to make, because we are asking for staff that are not just working on the program in the sense of writing decisions, but we also have surveyors and appraisers that are also working on it. So I think I need to clarify that as well as title staff. So not 1 staff in those programs are probably 100% just working on the remote rec program. But with the increased interest that we anticipate with this program, especially being able to nominate lands and having that permit option, we are asking for more assistance, and that would be also in our surveying, title, reclassifications that happens in our planning team. So that's why we do need that extra adjudication as well. So that's why we're asking for 5, is we do see that this would be a popular program and that it would take a lot more management for our team to be able to handle.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Director.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks. I'm reading the fiscal note, and it looks like division approximates 50 parcels per offering, and then maybe future anticipates more than that, and 10 acres per, so that's 500 acres annually. But I did have a question separate from that, or a request actually from the previous discussion we had on trapper cabins, and I had asked for from the sponsor of the trapper cabin bill sort of an idea, because we have a subdivision program, we have remote recreational staking cabins, we have trapper cabins, the ag lands in Tulchakit are different. They're all under different sort of programs for making sure that folks have access in either purchase or lease of land. And so and the personal use cabin bill, which is another one we had to deal with last year. So if we can get just sort of an idea of all of those different things. I had introduced a bill similar to this a little while back and then found out how difficult it was to try and figure out, because there's so many different ways to try to get land into public hands, which I really do appreciate the governor advancing this bill, bringing it to the committee here today. But I kind of want to know what's all of those programs that are out there.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. Yes, we actually do have something drafted, I think, from previous legislation. I had it updated, so I will make sure that the committee gets that chart so you can see all the different programs.
Thank you.
Good. Further questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, just looking at the cost, so that's coming out of UGF, correct?
Through the chair, that is correct, Senator Kaufman.
Yeah, thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up, yes.
I'm just wondering, is there a way to self-fund this if we're to have a DGF system set up, if this is selling property at a good value, there may be an opportunity to cover the cost through part of the proceeds.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, yes, I mean, I think that's something that we could consider. I know our current land disposal income fund is something we use for our land sales programs that we do have currently. But we do not think that with this additional staffing that we could support it with the current fund that we have, because it does have limitations.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the presentation. We will set this bill aside and take it up at another date. But thank you very much, Commissioner and Director, for being present today. All right, the final item on our agenda is Executive Order 128, separating the Board of Directors of AEA and the Board of Directors of the Alaska Industrial Export Authority. So while that new PowerPoint is being set up, there are five executive orders referred to the Resources Committee this year. This is the first hearing of Executive Order 128, of course. In your materials today, you have a legal memo regarding this EO. The legal finding is that the court would likely find it exceeds the governor's executive order authority under the Alaska Constitution. So I will let you take a look at that executive order. It does have a summary of Article 3, Section 23 of the Constitution, which outlines the limitations on the governor related to executive orders. I've asked Curtis Thayer to be here today to talk to us. He is the executive director of Alaska Energy Authority. And I believe Randy Raro also is online with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. In addition, online is Parker Patterson. He is the Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. So, welcome, Mr. Thayer.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And my testimony here relates to the merits of Executive Order 128. A little bit about the Alaska Energy Authority, which I think puts this whole executive order in context. AEA is responsible for railroad energy. We own the Bradley Lake Hydro Project, which is the largest hydro project in the state, as well as the Alaska Intertie, and then what we commonly call the SSQ line or Sterling to Quartz Creek transmission line, which benefits ratepayers along the rail belt from Homer all the way to Fairbanks. In addition to that, we have the Power Cost Equalization Program, known as the PCE program, where we have $45 million a year we're responsible in putting out to help subsidize the rates in rural Alaska so they resemble the rates on the rail belt, or at least between Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau on a weighted cost average. We also do rural energy planning and do constructing bulk fuel tank farms, diesel powerhouses, and helping with the electrical distribution grids. This is something that we do for communities. It's not something where we own these projects. We do these usually through state grants or state proceeds, and then we set up these programs in rural Alaska. To put it in perspective, there's 197 communities and powerhouses and 400 facilities in bulk fuel. So it's a fairly large program. Another one is renewable energy and energy efficiency. And this is where we provide technical assistance and analysis for alternative energy technologies, whether that be biomass, hydro, solar, wind. We have a team that works not only for urban Alaska, but also as subject matter experts in rural Alaska. We have grants and loans. Our grant program most commonly is the Renewable Energy Fund. Thanks to the legislature and the governor the last 3 years, $37 million has been put into that program. Over the life of that program, it's been $300 million. But we currently manage 60 active projects today that are in the early feasibility stage. And we recently had a third-party review look at the program over the last 15 years, and that program has displaced 85 million gallons of diesel fuel. So it's a wildly successful program, and we are in phase 16. It was just sent to the legislature as far as looking at funding round 16. And then as far as loans, we have a power project loan fund, where we have over $30 million out in loans, and we've never had a default. We've actually funded the two largest solar projects in Alaska, the Houston and Willow Solar Farm, using the Power Project Loan Fund. And then we have the energy planning, which is a collaboration with our regional partners, whether they be in rural Alaska or urban, and our most recent was the Governor's Energy Task Force, which was our latest activity over this last year. When you look at it from a map, this is active projects that AEA has ongoing on a monthly basis. Some of these might change a little bit, but we are literally across the state with projects. Under Executive Order 128, kind of the why, and that was is for the best interest of efficient administration to separate the membership of the Board of Directors of the Alaska Energy Authority from the membership of the Board of Directors of the Alaska Industrial Export Authority. Historically, from 1976 to around 1993, we had a separate board, and it was the legislature that combined us into one with ADA, and we've been governed by one Board of Directors. The distinct purpose is really the underlying purposes of ADA and AEA are fundamentally different. We have a very unique mission. Ours is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska, diversify Alaska's energy portfolio, and increase resilience, reliability, and redundancy. Our mission is growing, whether we look at owned assets or anything that we do across those assets or in rural Alaska. Kind of put it into something that surprised me when we actually ran the numbers, but our budget has increased over 1,004% in the last 4 years. And the interesting thing, that does not take into account the FY25 requests we have pending before the legislature. And when you look at the GRIP funding, which we can talk about, and others, our budget's going to increase 2,000 or 3,000%. And so really, you know, with it, you know, the governor is looking for a board with distinctive skill sets and expertise for optimal governance. It's common and appropriate to have a single purpose entity, to have a governing board made up of experts in that topic area. Nothing wrong with the ADA board. I respect them, and they spend a lot of time. But we have one volunteering board running two multi-billion dollar corporations and very distinct and different activities. In staffing, we currently have 48 PCNs at AEA. We are anticipating, working with the governor's office and the legislature, adding approximately 20 PCNs with the influx of federal dollars that we have to administer these programs. But there are 68 PCNs. ADA has 31. And so we're more than double personnel-wise, potentially larger than ADA. In addition to that, we do have shared services that we work with ADA. And when we talk about shared services, that's the HR function, that's IT, five accountants. We have more on our side of the house, so to speak. But I'm saying as far as accounts payable and that, we do share some of those functions between the two agencies. The new board makeup in the executive order would be the Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, as we currently have on the ADA board. And it also includes six public members appointed by the governor, one with an expertise, an electric utility that is not connected to a grid, so really a rural focus, one member with expertise in developing energy projects in rural Alaska, one member with an expertise or experience managing or operating electrical utility connected to a grid, the rail belt, and one member with financial expertise in large-scale energy project development. To put that into perspective, last December 22, we did close on $166 million bonding, which was to help with the Bradley Lake required project work. Prior to that, we bonded $17 million to secure the SSQ line. That issue, that particular SSQ line, a little history on that was a lot of lawsuits, first of all, it had fire damage done to it, and it was not operational for 4 months. There was some lawsuits with utilities, first responding and that. We stepped in with a partnership with the utilities and purchased that, extinguished the lawsuits. It's now part of AEA, and Homer manages it for us, but we have a working relationship with the utilities that we didn't have before. But again, we bonded with that, and then we were able to kind of take that experience, and 2 years later, bond again, and we did not raise the rates on the ratepayers, and we didn't ask for the legislature for that funding. So working together on that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Director. Could you explain the difference between A and B, sort of practically speaking? What's the difference between the qualifications for those members?
Well, we have one that is managing operating an electrical utility that is not connected to a grid. And then that could be anywhere in Southeast Alaska. Okay. You know, that could, you know, somewhere along that line. And the other one is really spells out rural Alaska. That's not saying that the both those two positions, they both can't be represented in rural Alaska, but there is a little bit different of just the rail belt. You know, you have Juneau is separated by their own grid. Ketchikan is from interconnected necessarily.
And on,
Kodiak.
And under our definitions, Kodiak, Ketchikan aren't rural.
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Question, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. I just, looking at the difference between A and B, I just wanted to comment that one appears to be managing a utility, and the other is in developing an energy project. So there's different expertise in managing operations than there is in developing or executing a project. So
through the chair, that's
I just wanted to mention that. Thank you.
You know, when we talked about a little bit of this, and that's just the growth we've experienced, you know, we expect continued anticipation of a substantial increase in federal funding. Just right now, we have $634 million in the pipeline. And when I say in the pipeline, it's money we'll be receiving. We have $84 million that we've already received in federal funding that we're putting out onto the street, whether that's electric vehicles, that's the Department of Defense grant. That also includes energy conservation and what we call a 401D grant program. And then we have 573 conditionally awarded. 413 million of that happens to be this large GRIP funding, which is to fund an HVDC line from Kenai over to Beluga, which is the redundancy off the Kenai Peninsula with newer technology than what we have been using for the last 60 years. You know, the one thing and the biggest challenge that we have on the rail belt is like Bradley. We can expand Bradley Lake. We can introduce renewables on the Kenai Peninsula. We do not have the transmission line capacity to move that to Anchorage. And this not only gives us the ability to expand so we have the capacity, but it gives us the redundancy that we need. And if we were a FERC-regulated entity in the lower 48, it's required you have two paths. And we are not FERC-regulated. We have one path. Yeah, that reaches from Homer to Fairbanks. Then we have 104 that are competitive applications that we currently have pending. So when you look at that, now we're pushing $750 million through AEA, which our board has to help manage us with. And then also we have available tax incentives for clean energy projects, direct reimbursement. Again, those are subject matter experts that would be helpful if we had that access with board representation that could with that. In addition, we say that we have a $1.3 billion net book value according to our financials, and we do have the $413 million. And then we're looking at the Dixon diversion, which is going to be well over $300 million. But the Dixon diversion would increase Bradley by 50%. And with that, it would displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas, or 7.5% of the need in 2030. And also, I think it's important for Bradley, and that is for our friends in the interior, currently 17% of all Bradley power at 4 cents goes to Fairbanks. So any improvement at the transmission line to make it more efficient and not have line loss is a benefit to everybody on the rail belt. And if we were to do the Dixon diversion, we would expect 17% of that diversion project would also go to Fairbanks. And then we have $90 million of railroad transmission upgrades, not in the budget, it was bonded money. I say not in the budget for the legislature, but $90 million, and that's for that SSQ line upgrade that was fire damaged and increasing that. That's where we have the weakest link on the Kenai Peninsula, and that's where we want to increase that from 115 to 230. And when we actually, a little bit get into the details, but when we actually purchased the line, it ran through the Moose Refuge. And at that time, we went ahead and got the right-of-ways to increase it when we purchased it. And we figured as long as they were willing to give us, change the ownership, we had to do a few things like pull the old 69 line out, but they gave us that right-of-way already. So we're already ahead of the ballpark, or ahead of the curve in that work. AEA statutory programs, I touched on them at the very beginning. We have the powerhouses, bulk fuel, renewable energy fund, the Alaska Intertie, the intertie that AEA owns from Willow to Healy, that ownership saves the Fairbanks community $37 million a year. And that is Golden Valley's number, not our number. But that's because they can buy power cheaper on the rail belt and ship it up on the AEA line, and we have no wheeling rights on that state-owned asset. We talked a little bit about required project work and how we bonded for $166 million, and that's when the Bradley bonds were paid off. One of the paths we could do was to have required project work as deemed by the Department of Law, and they deemed several projects. And so we were able to take that excess payment that soon was the debt service on Bradley, became excess payments, and able to turn that into bonding that was the $166 million. And that was all contemplated before GRIP and everything else came up. And of the $166, we had worked with the utilities that 65% of that would be transmission and 35% of that would be BESs or batteries, looking at home or MATS or the South Central Alaska and Golden Valley or up in Fairbanks. So kind of forward thinking in that regard. We've talked about the PCE and the renewable energy and energy efficiency programs that we manage. So when you look at it from that perspective, it just really, everything that we have going on, I think the governor feels that we would be better to have a strategically focused board in energy. And this is just a slide that references what our budget's done.
Very good question, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director, for being here, and we've had a chance to speak as well. But you know, I think I totally agree with you, actually, and agree with the governor. I think you've done a good job of laying out why you are so different from ADA and why you need to have a separate board. The problem is, of course, we have a legal opinion that said it's unconstitutional for the governor to do this through executive order. And so I apologize if it's in my documents. I've been sort of looking through and trying to find. Does the governor have a different legal opinion that you can share with us, or do you have an attorney online that could sort of lay out for us?
Senator Dunbar, there is an attorney from the Department of Law who no doubt wrote this EO. So if you'd like to hear from Parker Patterson right now, Assistant Attorney General.
Yes.
All right. Mr. Patterson, did you hear the discussion?
Yes, this is Parker Patterson. Can you hear me?
Yes, clearly.
Great. Again, Parker Patterson, for the record, through the chair, Senator, we do have a slightly different interpretation of this constitutional provision from Legislative Legal Services. So, and I'll clarify, I did not draft this particular one, but I am familiar with it and at least worked on a couple of the other ones. So with regard to this constitutional provision that this is based on, it's kind of got two components to it. It says that the governor may make changes in the organization of the executive branch and the assignment of functions among its units. And when doing so requires the force of law, it shall be done through an executive order. And so when we looked at that, it's actually a very unique constitutional provision. And we only really found one other state that has a provision like that, which is Michigan. And there's not a lot of case law in Alaska that addresses it. But we went back to the first principles and took a look at the text. And so what we kind of came to the conclusion is that, and I won't speak for Legislative Legal Services, but to the extent of that grant, it's really a grant of legislative power to the governor, right? It's part of that system of checks and balances where you kind of give one branch a little taste of the other branch's authority, and that everybody gets to kind of check each other. And so this is a narrow but deep kind of allocation. And there's two parts to it, right? There's the making changes in the organization, and then there's assignment of functions among the units. And so, and again, I won't speak for Legislative Legal Services, but to the end, my understanding of the objection that they've made is that they don't believe that an executive order can make what I think they're calling new law, because this would offend separation of powers. But in a system of checks and balances, when you have an express grant of authority, right, that overrides the general concern about separation of powers, and you have to go in and read and figure out what is the extent of the grant of authority. And so in those two components, we would agree with Legislative Legal Services to the extent of that second component, which is assignment of functions among the units, right? That's an assignment power, right? You can move things around, and you can take a power that one entity has and give it to another. But you couldn't delete one and you couldn't add a new one. But as to that first element, make changes to the organization of the executive branch, right? We see that as addressing kind of the structure or how the executive branch is set up, who's in it, right? And that is not an assignment, that is make changes. And there is simply just no way that you can make changes without making new law. It's impossible. And so from our point of view, to the extent you would have that interpretation, you would be interpreting the first part of the governor's power right out of the Constitution, because you cannot make changes to the organization that has the force of law without changing the law, without making new law. And, you know, and I'll give you an example, just a simple one. When in Executive Order 121, which spun off the new Department of Family and Community Services from PEP, right, we had to create a brand new section, which created a new department head. That was a brand new provision. It didn't exist anywhere else in Alaska law, because by definition, if you have a new department, it has got to have a new department head. And so there's certain aspects of the governor's power which he has to be able to create new law in order to have the power to reorganize the executive branch at all by executive order. And so here, right, this is to our point of view on all fours with this, because what we have here is we've got two different public corporations that are being run by one board and it's not working. And the governor comes along and he says, you know, this doesn't work. And so I need to restructure this. I need to reorganize these entities. And I'm going to do so by giving a new board, a separate board to each entity, right? And that requires that when I create a board for the AEA, well, I've got to say who's on that board. It's inherent in the concept that I'm going to create this thing, right? And so when the governor does that, he's got to have the power to establish who's on that board. And that is titled creating new law. And so from our point of view, when we read this thing, we believe that this is appropriate and correct exercise, exactly what this provision is intended to do. And we think a court looking at this would agree with that.
Is a brief follow-up?
Very brief, then we'll go to Ms. Nauman.
Apologies. So when the governor created the new department for the Department of Family and Child Services, were there requirements placed on that position? That is, some positions created by statute said you must be.
Excuse me, Senator Dunbar. Mr. Patterson, I believe your audio is on. We're getting feedback, echo. If you would turn off your computer. Go ahead, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, I want you to be able to do this, but I'm not persuaded the Constitution allows you to, because the executive order specifically lines out requirements for each of the board members. And so I'm wondering if in prior executive orders he's done that is, or a governor has done that, where they created a new position through your organization, but also says, and we're imposing this requirement. You know, they must be attorney general, you must be an attorney. To be the head of the National Guard, you must be serving in the United States military. You know, has the governor done that before? Did they do that with Child and Family Services? And are there any bounds to that, right? I mean, if he can or they can do it without consulting the legislature, could they impose any kind of requirement on filling that seat?
So I think a really good example is through the chair, I apologize. I think, Senator, I think a good example is Executive Order 27, which actually established an entire new commission, which was the State of Alaska Reconstruction and Development Planning Commission. And so he created that out of whole cloth and establish who was on the commission and what the commission's duties were. And they weren't, you know, creating new duties, but he was assigning duties that that the executive branch already had the power to do. And he was saying, I want this new entity to do this, right? So that was the idea there. And so, yes, it is within the power, inherently, again, within the power of the governor when he's establishing a new entity through executive order to create the contours of what that is and who's a part of that that new entity.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman, you are also online. Would you briefly go through your rationale of the memorandum you gave us?
No problem. For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Director of Legislative Legal Services. For the most part, the committee has sort of already meted out the argument and the Assistant Attorney General that I make in the memo, but I guess to put a finer point on it, the point we disagree on is whether or not the adding the qualifications and term limits and the number of board members is law beyond the reorganization that the governor is allowed to undertake under an executive order. And the memo in front of you argues that, in fact, it is beyond that power. As the Assistant Attorney General stated, this is a sort of a sliver of the legislative power prerogative given to the governor by the Constitution, and where that happens, we find that courts tend to interpret that power very narrowly. And so we believe that a court in Alaska would do the same and interpret it very narrowly. And I do want to point out, I think it's important to realize that just because the governor has undertaken reorganization or other changes similar to this and other executive orders, that doesn't guarantee that those were legal. It just means they weren't challenged. And I think that's the one thing that I would add to this conversation that might be helpful. I'm happy to talk in my memo or to my memo in more detail if the committee would find it useful. Otherwise, I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. So I don't see any questions at the moment. I will clarify, this committee is not making a decision on this executive order today. We're simply reviewing it. Online also, I have Randy Raro, Executive Director of the ADA, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Mr. Raro, comments on this executive order?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randy Raro, R-U-A-R-O. I'm the Executive Director for ADA. Madam Chair, the EO does not affect ADA's statutory mission of job creation and economic development, nor does it affect our board makeup or membership. Of course, ADA is free. It doesn't affect at all, of course, ADA's ability to continue to discuss, coordinate, and work with AEA to better the state's efforts on energy development. So the AO or the EO essentially leaves ADA alone.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Raro, for those comments. So in closing this conversation, as we near the end of this meeting, Mr. Thayer, any additional comments you would want to make?
I don't believe so at this time. I think we kind of laid out the merits of it and kind of the size and scope and how we've really grown over the 30 years. And we're just at a point where it just helped have a specialized board to help us with strategic development.
Very good. I think you've made the case well. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly. Hypothetically, if the EO is found to not be constitutional, I mean, or like I said, the legislature decides to disapprove it, are there any sort of vehicles you could see or that you would support sort of putting this in statute so we could do what you're trying to accomplish here?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that would really be a conversation with the governor's office and the legislature to determine. I think the merits are there. I think the vehicle the governor has chosen is an EO. I understand the legislature believes that maybe it's a bill, but I think the merits stand on the zone. It's just a conversation to have between policymakers.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With no further comments, that ends our meeting today. Our next meeting will be Friday, February 2nd at 3:30, the usual time. We will have the first hearing of Senate Bill 118, Critical Natural Resources. This is by Senator Merrick, and the first hearing of the public testimony on Executive Order 132, eliminating the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. So at this time, we will be adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:59 p.m.